Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, welcome to another episode of Test Talks, a podcast dedicated to all things test automation related. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com. In this episode, we're going to be speaking with Seb Rose, the author of the Cucumber for Java book, Keeping Your BDD Cucumbers Sweet. But first, talking about sweetness, let's hear it for our sweet sponsor, Sauce Labs. Today's episode is sponsored by Sauce Labs. Sauce Labs makes test automation awesome. Sauce's cloud-based Selenium Grid helps developers test web and mobile apps across more than 400 browser and OS platforms. Sauce also supports Appium and popular JavaScript unit testing frameworks and integrates with all the top programming languages, test frameworks, and CI systems. With built-in video recording, debugging tools, and secure tunneling for firewall testing, Sauce helps you ship better software faster. Sign up at saucelabs.com with promo code TESTTALKS14 and get 20 hours of automated testing for free. Hey, I work for a large team, and there is nothing worse than having sour BDD. And I think you know the kind of BDD tests that I'm talking about, the kind that are unreliable, they're unreadable, they're unmaintainable, they're just a mess, and you still have to somehow maintain them, and they drive you crazy. In this episode, you're going to discover a better way with Seb Rose, the author of the Cucumber for Java book, as he shares some of the best ways to create robust, sweet, behavior-driven development tests that will leave you satisfied and your customers delighted. Check it out. Hey, Seb. Welcome to Test Talks.
I'm glad to be here, Joe. Thanks for inviting me.
Cool. So it's great to finally have you on the show. I really loved the original Cucumber book. It was geared towards Ruby, but the new one is Cucumber book for Java. So before we get started, though, can you just tell us a little bit more about yourself, Seb?
Sure. So I've been a developer for 30 plus years. I started off while I was still at school, at high school. I was programming accountancy software for solicitors and real estate agents on an Apple II. Cool. In compiled BASIC. And I then went to university and did computer science. And I've been a developer, trainer, coach for the past 30 years. Quite a lot of the time I've been a freelancer, a contractor, as we say in the UK. I've worked for financials and engineering companies mainly. And then maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I worked for a couple of years for Rational IBM, and then went on to work at the Amazon Development Center in Scotland, which is a small development center that owns a few of the interesting products within the Amazon ecosystem. And then after that, I've moved on into consultancy, mainly in the area of agile training, test-driven development, and crucially for this interview, I think, behavior-driven development, often using the Cucumber tool.
Awesome. And today, that's what I really want to focus on is BDD and your awesome new book, The Cucumber for Java book. So why did you decide to write The Cucumber for Java book?
I met Matt Wynn at a conference a couple of years ago, and we started working together doing training in BDD. And in the beginning of 2011, or maybe the end of 2011, beginning 2012, Aslak Hersøy released the first version of Cucumber JVM. So as you said in your introduction, Cucumber was originally a Ruby tool. And although Cucumber itself can interface with pretty much any system, it's quite useful to be able to get the Cucumber steps to call directly into the application that you're building. And Gojko Adjic, who you may be familiar with for writing the Jolt Award-winning Specification by Example book, yep. Had produced something called the Ninja Turtle Scrolls, I think, or the Secret Ninja Scrolls.
Yes, it's a great site.
And he'd also written a tool for trying to get Ruby Cucumber to work on the JVM. It did work, but it was a bit brittle. There were a lot of moving parts, and it wasn't the simplest thing to to give people to work with. And so Aslak and some of the Cucumber team began a porting effort to implement or re-implement Cucumber on the JVM natively. And when that got released, I was one of the early people to start using it in my consultancy and with one of the clients that I was working with. And then when I started working with Matt, we got to know each other, and Matt asked me whether I would like to port the book to Java. So that's what happened. If you look at the book, you'll see that it's got all three names on the cover. So Matt and Aslak were the authors of the original Ruby book. My name's at the top there because actually, although they were there to help me answer questions, they didn't actually do a great deal when it came to writing the book, because they'd already done the structure and getting the text right for some of the non-technical areas of the book.
Awesome. And actually, I interviewed Matt a few months back, and I just mentioned that I love that book, but I actually use Java, not Ruby. And the reason why I love the book is for all the non-Ruby stuff that was in there, all that information. So what's great about this book, it's about Java, and it contains all the other higher level stuff, the more wisdom, tips and tricks type stuff also. So I was really excited to see it available.
Yeah, a few people have not so much complained, but have said it's a shame that that first section is pretty much identical between the Ruby version and the Java version. But our feeling and the feeling of the publisher was that most Java shops wouldn't have bought a book for a Ruby tool. And so we needed to get that higher level overview of what behavior-driven development is so that into the Java book, so that product owners and managers on a Java team would have a place to go to get that information.
Awesome. Yeah, I definitely agree. I think it just adds more value. And I have the original, and I'm going to buy this book also. I've been reading it online with my Safari subscription. But for some reason, I love hard copies, so I'll probably order it. So you have to have the actual versions.
Of course, we win over because we've got Uncle Bob doing the introduction.
Nice.
So Dan North was nice doing the introduction, but you know, having Uncle Bob on the cover is always a good thing.
So actually, bringing up Dan North, are there any differences between Cucumber JVM and JBehave? And if there are, do you know why one would be better, or are they both the same but just different flavors? They both do the same thing.
So essentially, they do the same thing. There are some subtle differences around using steps and reusing steps. JBehave behaves in a different way than Cucumber for Java or the Cucumber family behaves. And I guess down at the at the top level, maybe the first thing people see is that JBehave uses stories and has an idea around a story, whereas Cucumber talks about features. Now, I'm not an expert in JBehave. I've never used JBehave in anger. What I do know is that JBehave, although it uses Gherkin, it uses it in a slightly different way, and the approach is subtly different. The nice thing about Cucumber is that actually, with only one very slight exception, the Gherkin and the way it works is exactly the same whether you're using a Ruby version, a JVM version, a PHP version, or in fact the .NET version.
The reason why I ask is when my company first started doing BDD, they chose JBehave as the company-wide tool to use. And I always wanted to know, how come we just didn't use Cucumber JVM? I guess maybe Cucumber JVM was maybe in its infancy at the time. So that's probably why.
When did you adopt JBehave?
About 2.5 years ago, 2 years ago.
Yeah, so I mean, I think version one of Cucumber JVM came out probably mid-2012. So it just wasn't mature at that time.
The book is broken up into three main sections. You have the fundamentals, you have working examples, and a more techniques section. So can we start with the fundamentals? For a person who doesn't know, what is Cucumber? What is this BDD thing that we're talking about? Why should we care?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. I guess the first thing to say is that behavior-driven development has nothing to do with Cucumber or JBehave or Fitness or anything like that. Behavior-driven development is an approach where we encourage non-technical and technical members of the team, so the product owner, the customer, and the development and QA, to get together and start to investigate what a story or a feature should look like by using concrete examples. And those concrete examples allow us to uncover the acceptance criteria for a particular part of the application. That whole conversation empowers, deliberate discovery and learning about what the product should do. And that's at the core of behavior-driven development. And in fact, Liz Keogh, who many of you, the people listening, might be familiar with, one of the things that she says regularly is that BDD, it's about having the conversation. Once you've got that conversation really working well, then it's great to record that conversation and use that as a specification of what you're trying to build. And once you're good at recording the conversation, then you might want to start thinking about automating those artifacts, those examples, and using them as automated acceptance tests. And so BDD, you get a huge value from having that conversation and you get more value from writing it down. And then Cucumber comes in pretty much at the end of that process, where you will then take those examples and those acceptance criteria that you've developed during your conversation with your product owner, and you'll then automate them, and they will become what's sometimes called executable specification or living documentation. And it will actually drive that English language specification that you've worked on with your product owner will then drive your product that you're developing. And those scenarios will either pass or fail, letting you know what you've developed is what the customer asked, or sometimes that you haven't developed it yet, or that you've introduced a defect.
Is a scenario considered a requirement within a feature?
So a scenario, I wouldn't say a scenario is a requirement as such. When we try and map these things back to some more conventional or maybe older school ways of thinking around requirements, things get a bit muddled. BDD quite blatantly came out of the agile ways of working. And to some extent, what we do in the BDD area is we look at features and stories that go into making up that feature. And so a feature is some sort of capability that the product is going to offer. And then when within that feature, we then try and use stories in the agile way of working to deliver small slices of functionality and iteratively and incrementally build that feature up into something that is of value to the customer. For each of those small stories, we have a discussion with the product owner, and that's a meeting that, if you follow the BDD school of terminology, it'll be called the Three Amigos meeting. Mm-hmm. And in that meeting, we try and explore that story with concrete examples, possibly make the story small and split it into constituent parts. And so the thing that we're really driving at here is examples to illustrate acceptance criteria. And the acceptance criteria are the business rules that scope that part of the feature. So they definitely mesh with requirements, but if you were to look at a requirement document that says the user should be able to do this and should be able to do that, there's not necessarily a one-to-one mapping between those requirements expressed in the traditional requirements way and acceptance criteria expressed as rules that scope a user story.
Awesome. The reason why I bring this up is I don't know, you have a lot of experience with consulting, talking to other companies, and I'm just curious to know how BDD behaves in the wild. I mean, I love the concept of BDD. I love the fact that we should be having conversations. But from my experience working with a large enterprise with 8 Scrum teams, it's a little different. And mainly because our managers are coming from a waterfall to an agile type process. So they say scenarios are requirements. And when they do that and you try to educate them, they're really sticking to their guns. And it just makes it hard to really get the benefit of the BDD, which is the conversation. So basically, developers are just treating it like a checklist on their definition of done. Yeah, BDD, automation. So in your experience, how does BDD behave in the wild, or how do you usually educate an organization like that to teach them of what the true benefits are of BDD? I know that's a long-winded question, but...
So it's not a long-winded question, and it's a really important question, because a lot of organizations are like that. And unfortunately, what you're asking is a tough question, because what we're really trying to do is change the way we think about software development. We're trying to say it's not about being handed requirements and you just checking them off. It's about the interchange between people from different roles with different skill sets and with different understandings of how the system gets together. So if you treat scenarios, BDD scenarios, as requirements, and your product owner or customer authors them and passes them off to the development team, who then implement them and automate them, that's a one-way process, and you're likely to end up with misunderstandings in exactly the same way as we did when we used 200-page requirement documents that got signed off at a staged gate. And if you don't have that feedback mechanism of developing these scenarios together working on the ubiquitous language so that everybody understands unambiguously what's being meant, and having the opportunity for the QA team, the test team, and the developers to really probe what the product owner or the customer's vision is, then we're likely to have exactly the same gap between what the customer wanted and what the development team deliver that we've always had. And you'll be missing out on most of the benefits. I think probably what you described in the question around the business only wanting it to be a requirement is one of the main anti-patterns that I see irregularly in business. And possibly the other most commonly seen anti-pattern is where people come and say, oh, we need to speed up testing. Cucumber BDD will improve our test automation effort. And both of these lead to scenarios that are quite often overly technical, quite brittle, slow, and not delivering the value that the whole BDD process can deliver when done in a collaborative way.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that some companies oversell it as a silver bullet, almost like you said. It's going to make us to be able to run tests faster and get all these automated tests out of it. And basically what they end up having is the same issues you always have with test automation, is you get brittle, unstable tests sometimes because, you know, you're focusing more on the automation rather than on the quality, the conversations, making sure you're developing what your users really want. And it's just a shame, and it's just hard. It's just a hard problem, like you said, to try to change, to make change and get people to open their minds a little bit to this newer way of thinking.
Well, so people always love silver bullets, even though we all know there's no silver bullet. It's so much simpler to add a new tool to the stack of tools that we use than to change anything about the way we actually go about our lives.
Absolutely. So let's dive down a little bit more technical, I guess. So in your book, is there any specific tip that you find most helpful or most people have been talking about in regards to Java with Cucumber that maybe they didn't know about or they found really helpful?
That's an interesting question. So there's a lot of stuff in there. I would say that the first part, which isn't in the technical section, it's in the fundamentals, is that we've renamed chapter 6, I think it is. In the original book, the chapter was called When Your Cukes Go Bad. And in this book, it's called Keeping Your Cucumbers Sweet. Because what we found was that a lot of people skipped over chapter 6 because they said, oh, well, our cucumbers haven't gone bad, so we don't need to read this chapter. So we've turned it into a prophylactic. You should read this chapter first, because if you read this chapter and understand it, then your cukes will, your scenarios will remain easy to maintain, easy to run, and comprehensible. But your question was around technical, and I would say that a lot of the technical stuff in the Java area is very similar to the way the Ruby works. Obviously, syntax is different, but the important stuff that's different, I guess, is around the dependency injection. So in Cucumber for Ruby, the original Cucumber, data was shared between the different step definition files using the Cucumber world, which was essentially a global object that got shared around. That's not replicated in the Cucumber JVM. In Cucumber JVM, we use dependency injection, which is, it's not specifically a Java technology by any means, but it's quite familiar to Java developers. And Cucumber JVM is integrated with quite a lot of the main common dependency injection containers. The one that is lightest weight is another one that was developed by Aslak Kerasoy, and it's called Pico Container. It's very lightweight and very easy to use, but it's also integrated with more well-known dependency DI containers such as Juice or Spring, and even a couple of CDI containers such as Weld.
I was always a little jealous of the Weld example. So what you're saying is dependency injection, you can get the same type of behavior that you could with Ruby with the Weld functionality?
Well, to some extent, I think you can get better functionality. Nice. And the nice thing about dependency injection is that you can use contextual objects to share data in a much more compartmentalized way. So if you're using the Weld, every step definition gets a copy of the world, and so there's no way that you can limit the scope of what a step definition can access. Whereas with dependency injection, you can create as many context classes as you like and share them just by specifying which ones you want to be injected into a particular definition class. So in that way, the surface area or the amount of knowledge that a step definition has of the rest of the moving parts in the application can be severely limited, and thus you keep the encapsulation much more tightly under control. So for instance, if you have a step definition file, you can share something about the UI and something about some business logic, but there may be another step definition file that is only to do with the UI, and a third step definition file that only needs to know about the business logic. And you can separate those concerns out and only share the information that the actual steps need to know about.
I have to admit, I need to learn a little bit more about dependency injection, I think, because that framework, I think, might suffer from that. It sounds like it helps it so that you don't have bloated step definitions.
It helps make sure that the step definitions remain focused in the area that they're supposed to be focused. So I guess one of the, maybe I should backtrack a little bit. For those people listening who maybe aren't so familiar with the way Cucumber works, what you do is you write your scenarios in the business language using given, when, then terminology. And they're stored in text files, which are known as feature files. And so each feature file relates to an area of functionality in your application. Each line in your scenario is linked to a piece of Java executable code using regular expression matching. So basically the text of your step, so given I have logged into such and such a website, that will map through to a regular expression in the Java file, I have logged into this website, and it will execute that code. Now, the Java code, the steps should be organized not in the same way as the feature files are, so not by functionality, but by domain concepts. So we'll have step definition files, one that deals with customers, one that deals with logging in, one that deals with, in this particular example, it was an ATM, so something to do with banking. We have a different layout of steps within our step definition file than we do features, scenarios within our feature file. And the reason is because when you're thinking about functionality of your application, you want to be able to see all of this, the scenarios that explore a particular piece of functionality in one file. It's like documentation. But when it comes to reuse and implementation, you find that particular domain entities will get used by many different features. So if you think in terms of an account will get used when you log in, it will get used when you add money, when you try and take money out. And so that wants to be organized where all of the steps, all the step definitions that deal with managing and manipulating accounts should be in the same Java file. So you have your step definition files, which that are organized not by feature capability, but by domain concept. And now that domain concept has, depending on the domain concept, it needs very different information to be able to interact with your application. So probably your account doesn't need to know anything about the UI. So you don't need to inject into it any web server type, a web driver type classes, but it will need to know about how to access the backend services. So in this way, we can start to break down the context that each step definition file needs to know about into components that can then be shared on a need to know basis. And now you can see by just looking at the constructor of the account step definition file, you can see, this is a set of steps that it only needs to know about the backend services. And if you find yourself trying to access a UI through it, you'll find that you don't have access to that UI. And it gives really fast feedback about where the functionality should go.
Awesome. Yeah, great advice. I think I actually probably have to do a lot of refactoring in our framework because they write a dot feature called like search patient, and then they have a step definition called, you know, search patient, and then it calls a page object, which luckily is, you know, more generic. But it's hard because there's 8 scrum teams and you're shepherding all these different teams across the different parts of the country and different parts of the world, actually. So I think that's great advice.
It all stems back, I guess, to Eric Evans' domain-driven design from the late 90s. So the ubiquitous language, which is what the scenarios, the feature files are written in, that's something that's owned by the whole team. But as soon as you delve beneath that into essentially the automation code, that's very much developer-centric. And we need to apply standard development practice techniques to keep that maintainable and easy to modify. So at that point, you want to be thinking about not repeating yourself, about not breaking encapsulation, about keeping the architectural layers separate.
So far we spoke about, you know, what is BDD, how to write scenarios, the best practices maybe for step definitions. So once we have all these BDD and scenarios, and once we do have some that are automated, not every scenario needs to be automated, but that is a side benefit if you do it correctly, besides the communication. So you have all these automated tests now. So do you have any best practices, say, how to run this in CI? Do you just do like a run star dot feature and just run every single feature? Or in your experience, do you know if people usually break them out by tags? Do you have any tips around that?
So to some extent, this is something that you have to pick up within your own context. If you've got a small application and you're doing a lot of quite fast tests, then maybe you'll only have one stage in your CI pipeline and it can run all of the Cucumber scenarios. More typically, what you see over time is applications grow. Who would have thought it? And the set of scenarios that you want to run grows with it. Now, there's a number of different ways of thinking about this. So quite often, the advice given is that you push some of the scenarios down out of the executable specification and move them into unit tests so that they can run faster. Another way, another approach, is, as you mentioned, is using tags. So tags are just freeform text which you annotate, which you can use to annotate any scenario. And then Cucumber accepts logical expressions made up of these tags, so it can decide which scenarios needed to run in this particular part of the CI pipeline. And typically what you'll see is that people will tag them with fast and slow. You might tag them with UI or service layer. You can also tag them by the release that they're going into or defect numbers that they have been written in response to. And this gives you a huge amount of power to split a large monolithic suite of scenarios that might take hours to run into smaller focus suites that you can run on demand to give you feedback on a particular area that you're working in. And then what you quite often see is you'll see a number of CI stages within the pipeline, and you'll start off with some fast tests that give you some confidence that you haven't broken everything, and then subsequent stages in the pipeline will run more full or slower suites of tests to pick up any edge cases that might have got through.
Awesome. I love that concept of CI stages in the pipeline. The reason why is, like you said, our test set has grown rather large. And the problem is developers are like, it takes too long to run. Why? I'm not going to run. So before they even check into Int, they don't even bother to run against our CI environment because it takes too long to run the tests. And I've been trying to tell everyone we should break them up into stages. But for some reason, they're like, no, you need to run every single one. And I'm thinking that's probably an anti-pattern. If a developer's making a change in a section of your application and you know it doesn't touch any other piece, maybe we have these stages where you run the fast test first, give them fast feedback, let them know, okay, at a high level, it looks like you didn't hose anything. And then maybe run the longer test suites, maybe overnight. So when they come in the morning, then they have even more information.
Sure, absolutely. And also, of course, I would be expecting your developers to be writing unit tests anyway before they check the code in. And so that's something that I would definitely expect the devs to be running on their desktop before any check-in.
Awesome. Once again, it goes back to the issue we have with how they define scenarios or requirements. So for some reason, in order to get credit, they need to have a scenario. So even if it makes sense to make it more of a unit test, they only get credit if it's a scenario. So it's really bizarre. But so we do have unit tests. We definitely need them. But for some reason, just the way the process has been defined is kind of, like I told Matt, it's kind of perverted the way we do it. So
yeah. So in this new version, in the Java version of the book, maybe the chapter that I should point you to, given that you've read the Ruby version, is chapter 13, which is entitled Keeping Your Features Fast. Mm-hmm. And it talks there specifically about partitioning features and scenarios, but it also introduces a concept that Matt and I came up with, which is called the testing iceberg. So a lot of people listening will be familiar with the testing pyramid, which tries to get across the message that we want lots of fast, small unit tests as the foundation of our development testing. And then as the tests exercise more and more of the application, so they go through integration tests up towards end-to-end system tests, you have fewer tests that do that. So that's the pyramid. And what we found is that the question is often asked, well, which tests should we write in using Cucumber and features, and which tests should we use JUnit and unit tests for? And a lot of places answer that question by saying, well, they draw a line somewhere halfway up the pyramid, and everything above the line gets done in Cucumber, and everything below the line gets done in JUnit. But what we've seen is that actually it's not, that decision is actually orthogonal. There are some tests that are short, fast, unit-style tests, but it's really important to write them up in the ubiquitous language because they describe and validate behavior that is important to your business. Whereas there are some end-to-end system-style tests which your business isn't interested in, and you might as well not pay the price of having to code them up in Cucumber, and you can do them cheaply in Java using JUnit. And so we introduced the testing iceberg to try and get this message across. You probably need to look at a picture. I could try describing it, but I wouldn't do a very good job. But essentially, it's the testing pyramid skewed on its side with a line drawn along the middle, which we call the readability waterline. And everything above the readability waterline is of interest to the business and should be written in the ubiquitous language using Cucumber or another tool like that. And everything below the readability waterline is really only of interest to the technical team and can be written in unit testing language of your choice.
So that's a great tip. I actually didn't get to this chapter yet. Now I'm just looking at it now. You do have an image of what most people are probably familiar with is the testing pyramid, where you have the unit test as your base, as the largest amount of tests. And then integration at the top, you have GUI. But you have a new way of looking at it also, where you break it down into technical and business readable. So it looks like it's going to really complement what we know already and maybe enhance our understanding of how we think of what tests, at what level they should be done at. So,
awesome. There's one other thing that I'd like from that last statement that you just made. I hope you don't mind, but I want to pick you up on it.
Sure.
You talked about the testing pyramid, and you said going from unit test as the foundation to the GUI.
Integration, unit, rest test, yep.
Yeah, so I mean the pyramid does go from unit tests at the bottom through integration tests to end-to-end tests at the top. And one of the things, and this is actually nothing to do with Cucumber, but one of the things that I feel quite strongly about is that end-to-end tests don't necessarily involve the UI, and that you should be able to unit test your GUI because it's just another component. So if you think back to MVC, the view is just a component. If you can stub out the model and the controller, there's no reason why you can't test the UI as a component or as a unit within your system. And thus you can get really repeatable, fast tests of your UI. And I think it's worth mentioning this because quite often people think that the only way you can test your UI is by spinning up the whole system and driving it as an acceptance test. Whereas in fact, if you architect it in a way that allows you to substitute in mock controllers and models, then there's no reason at all why you shouldn't be able to unit test or component test your UI.
Awesome. I think that's great advice. And that's probably, if people can do that and execute on that, they're going to save themselves a lot of heartbreak, because if anyone's been doing GUI automation for any amount of time, they know how difficult it is to make it reliable. So you're saying if you can find a way to mock out certain things, you can help speed up the effort and make it more reliable?
Yeah, absolutely. So online you'll find a pattern known as presenter first pattern documented. And that's one way of going about it, which thinks about, it's a modification of the MVC model. But essentially, if you draw out the MVC pattern as blocks and arrows, you can see that the view, which is your UI, has well-defined channels of communication with the model and the controller. And if you can replace those at test time with models and controllers that your tests create and control, then there's no reason why you can't just test that the UI behaves in the way that you want. And you can set your model and your controller up to mimic all sorts of bizarre behaviors that may or may not happen in error conditions or when networks go down or when someone pulls the plug out.
I definitely need to research that a little bit more. I guess one of our biggest struggle, and this might help, is with data, having test data consistent across different environments. But if we're mocking more things, we could probably control the data that we're actually using for our UI tests. And that might help with the data dependency issues that we're currently facing.
Absolutely. So, I mean, obviously, it only helps with your testing the UI. If you want to test the whole workflow, then you may get into data issues. But if you can control the data, for instance, using something like I don't know, data mother or data builder type pattern within your tests to create just the data that you need on demand. Maybe even just create it in memory so that you don't have to bother with slow disk access or slow database access. Then everything becomes much more resilient, much more responsive, and robust to changes.
Awesome. So Seb, are there any Java libraries that you find yourself using a lot to help you with your BDD step definitions?
Well, so I do use Selenium WebDriver a lot. Nice. Because despite all that I've said about running fast tests not through the UI, there's still often a lot of UI testing in there. I use mocking libraries quite a lot. I don't know which ones you use in your shop, but I'm a big fan of JMock. Apart from that, it really depends on the application and the style of implementation of the client that I'm working with. So in general, I try not to introduce new technologies because normally the problem is there's too many technologies already.
Yeah, I agree. I guess my favorite is Rest Assured for REST-based testing. I find that a really great library to use.
I haven't used that one, but I think what's worth pointing out is that Cucumber does is link the English language, business language feature files up to a method that's been annotated with a regular expression. Underneath that, you can use any library you like.
Yep.
So if you use WebDriver, then you can automate or you can run against any application that's running through its UI, no matter what language it's written in, no matter what technology stack it's sitting on top of. But equally, you can chuck in there the Rest Assured library, and you can then drive any application that's got a REST API, or you can put in any other flavor of library that you like and talk to applications using your own protocols if you want to.
Okay, Seb, before we go, is there one piece of actionable advice you can give someone to improve their Java BDD Cucumber efforts? And let us know the best way to find or contact you.
Okay. The most important thing is that this is a tool to support collaboration. If you are not able to collaborate with somebody who's responsible for the customer or business side, then please don't try using Cucumber for a test automation product. If you want to do test automation, go and get a dedicated test automation tool. I don't think you'll have any success, but don't use Cucumber, because I know that we will not be supporting you in the way that you want it to work. It is designed as a collaboration tool, or to support collaboration. You can contact me through Twitter. I tweet as Seb Rose, and my website is claysnow.co.uk. where I blog occasionally, and you'll find an email address there as well.
Thank you, Seb, for your BDD Cucumber Java awesomeness. For links to everything of value that we talked about in this episode, head on over to www.testtalks.com/53. And while you're there, make sure to click on the more info link under the exclusive sponsor section to hear more about Sauce Lab's awesome products and services. Also, I would love it if you had a second to subscribe in iTunes and leave a review, or subscribe in Stitcher and leave a review. Those go a long way in terms of exposure and helping new people come along and see that this show is worthwhile. And it's easy. All you need to do is head on over to testtalks.com, and on the right-hand side, you'll see links for both iTunes and Stitcher to get started. Speaking of iTunes, I just want to give a shout-out to two new reviews in iTunes. The first one is from the performance Sherpa himself, Mark Tomlinson, who is the host of the Must Listen To podcast on performance testing, Perf Bytes. So if you don't subscribe to Test Talks, at a minimum, you should definitely subscribe to Perf Bytes. So thank you, Mark, for that review. I really appreciate it. And also thank you, MC Disease. I don't know where you get these handles from, but thank you, MC Disease, for your review. Thank you so much. I really do appreciate these reviews. Well, that's it for another episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my mission is to help you succeed with automation awesomeness. Until we talk again, as always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.